We have coming up, Parshas B'Shalach, where it goes and tells us about how Hashem was going and leading us, that the reason why Hashem didn't go and take us, Derech Eretz Plishtim, is because it was the fast way. That would seem to be exactly the reason to go and take us that way. We go and see some ways in which the Lashon that we have in the Pasuk, Ki Karovu, the Mefarshim have to go and jump through hoops, where they go, what does Ki mean? How would we go and translate key, just very basically? Because this is the reason why, and yet what the Mefarshim have to go and do is they jump through hoops telling us this is the way Hashem took us despite the fact that it was close. And then we get a lot more insights into why we couldn't go, why we had to spend the 40 years in the Midbar. And so think about that as we're going through these next stages here. Let me go and plant another seed, what's becoming one of my favorite sugyas in Gemara. This is from Baba Metzia. This is from Daf Pei Dalet. Really easy to remember because Pei Dalet is Daf backwards. And so you can go and remember that this is the Daf that has the relationship between the most iconic of the Chavrusa duos in the Gemara. Who are the most iconic of the Chavrusa duos? Rabbi Yochanan, Reish Lakish. And it goes through a whole bunch of their history, how things started off for them. Then the evolution of when they are Chavrusas, and then the part I'm going to talk about this time, last time we talked about when they were Chavrusas and a lesson we can go and learn from them, this is going to talk about the tail end. This is at the tail end when they went and had, let me give you a little bit of the background. So we had this iconic Chavrusa that then Reish Lakish was Nifter, Reish Lakish passed away, and they went and found a great solution. Let's go and take another Gadol Hador, Rav Lazar ben Pedas, to be the next Chavrusa that Rabbi Yochanan is going to have. And Rav Yochanan is going, integrating this next Chavrusa in with him, and he is devastated by this Chavrusa. Despite the fact that he was a Gadol Hador, he had a very different style compared to Reish Lakish. What was Reish Lakish's style when they were having that Chavrusa there? He would go and throw 24 darts at everything that Rav Yochanan would say. Objections, all sorts of ways that they had, back and forth. And then when Rav Lazar ben Pedas was coming on board, he was... Everything was this Messiah-lach. That's brilliant, Rabbi Yochanan. Let me go and give you supports to that. Let me go and show why you're right about it. And that was devastating to Rabbi Yochanan. And what Rabbi Yochanan said to him, that in contrast to Reish Lakish, Hayimakshili, Esrim Arba Kushiyata, that there were, he would go and ask me 24 questions. You are going, Ad Amrit Tanya de Messiah-lach. And so we had this very different way that Rabbi Lazar ben Pedas was going and coming to this Chavrusa. Why? When he's getting this feedback from Rav Yochanan, couldn't Rav Elazar ben Pedas adjust his style? Why couldn't he go and hear the coaching, be able to go and see why this is a way in which I have to go and be able to fit into what Rav Yochanan is going and seeing as the way that he was magically formed into a Gadol Hador through that back and forth with Reish Lakish? And so we're going to take these two questions. Why do we have to go for 40 years in the Midbar, despite the fact that there was a much shorter way? And why couldn't Rav Elazar ben Pedas adjust? And we're going to come back around to those and see there's actually a common reason to the two of these things. So with that as our lead into it, let me go and start getting into a little bit, also another Inyana Diyoma from this month being Siyu month. What do you see there? January 4th, 2020. Wait, what was the other?
Yeah, I didn't say that, but I know we're going
with it. That what?
I said April 1st.
April 1st, 2020. What's the difference between these? Okay, the day, month, the way it is going laid out, we instinctively go and attribute some kind of information to this, some kind of way in which it has something that's communicating to us that's actually pretty different based on where we are coming from. So if there was someone from Eretz Yisrael in the audience, what would they have said about what this is? They would have said April 1st, 2020. And yet all of us were seeing what when we were first seeing it? We were seeing January 4th, 2020. This hit me a little over a year ago when I got an email from a daughter of mine. She had graduated Stern a couple of years ago. She had been in Israel for a couple of months because she was going to be a lone soldier in the army. She had sent me on January 1st, Mazel Tov Abba. I saw that the Siyum HaShas is going to be coming up a year from now. So that was this past January 1st. That you're within a year of doing it. I sent back to her, no, actually, the Siyum, I didn't realize that MetLife Stadium had jumped the gun by 3 days. I sent back to her, asked her, we're going to be finishing Daf on 1/4/20. Well, you see up here on this. She sent back to me, Abba, I've been here a little bit too long because when I first saw that, I thought the Siyum is going to be on April 1st, 2020. And so this is where we have the different ways that we go and read the world, we see information in the world that's shaped by the mindset that we go and bring to it, and where we have to go and tune into that. Because a lot of times, just like she had in Eretz Yisrael, she might go and misread a date and not realize that the Israelis are communicating to her something different. The start on her apartment, when she's going to be able to go and move in. Maybe there's a disconnect between how she's reading the date that they're telling her in the contract and the thing that she's seeing there. Or what if I had gone and said to her, can you please come and pick me up after the Siyum HaShas? And she would be showing up 3 months late to go and pick me up from the Siyum. And so this is where we have to go and tune in a little bit to how we look at the world differently and how that is shaped by where we are coming from. Just to give you a little bit of insights also into her sense of humor a little bit. A little bit later, I got an email from her. She was saying, Abba, yesterday was April 7th, so I celebrated July 4th. So a little bit about 4/7/19 versus 7/4/19. Two very different things in each of those countries where we go and see that differently. And so there's just one little microcosm of how where we're coming from goes and shapes the way that we go and view the world. Let's go and take one other microcosm for you. Does anyone know what this car is? A taxi. I'm very proud of you. That's an ancient generational thing that we used to have here. There was a New York Times article on someone who got arrested for getting out of a taxi. Why would that person get arrested for getting out of a taxi? Didn't pay. Why would they not pay? Doesn't everyone know that you go and pay when you get out of a taxi? Why would he have not paid? Because he had gotten used to the Uber model. He used to go in a taxi, and then what's the Uber model? What is the mental way in which we go and deal with Ubers? We go, the pay is taken care of. You get to your destination, and what is the first thing you go and do out of the car? You get out, you leave. What do you do in a taxi? You get out and you leave, and you get arrested. This is where we have to go and grapple with in a new situation, that mindset that we're bringing to it, whether it's in Eretz Yisrael with dates, whether it's where we're getting out of a car when it's a very different model that we've gotten used to, and then we have to go and adjust to that new situation. This is what we're going to call, and this is taking a little bit from entrepreneurship, what we call your mental blueprint. Blueprint is the way that you have developed about how the world works, how you go and look at the people, how they interact, the incentives of people. The blueprint is one of the things that we're going to go and tap as we go and take a look through a bunch of these examples of where we're seeing all the way from Parshas Beshalach to Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan to 1/4/20, where our blueprints are something we have to tune into. We have to be able to be cognizant of it because it has some fundamental implications for how well we're going to be able to go and adjust to new situations, the inflection points in life, the ways in which we're dealing with other people and how their blueprints might be different from ours. Let's go and take, I don't know, is anyone in the Founders Dilemmas course? Okay, so we have a couple of you who are in here. Okay, this is actually something that you're going to be doing tomorrow. So I guess this is going and fast-forwarding to one of the concepts that you're going to be going and doing there. Don't go and spoil the class tomorrow too much. But this is one of the concepts. I'm going to take the case study that they're going to be going and doing tomorrow. And we're going to go and see a little bit about a richer perspective on these blueprints, the mental models that we go and bring to the world. Any baseball fans here? Okay, so we got a bunch of hands up in the air. Okay, anyone know who this is? Kurt Schilling. Okay, the very hated name, I think, in this geography here. Okay, this was, for those of you who aren't familiar with him, he had come to the Boston Red Sox when they were in the midst of an 86-year-old drought on their being able to go and win. He came in as the savior. He was going and intending that we're going to end this drought, we're going to go and win the World Series. This is the mindset that he brought to everything. To go and deepen the mindset, does anyone remember what was happening? Game 6? The bloody sock. So this is when he was going and starting Game 6. This is critical in terms of a game for his team. They were down 3-0. They came back 3-1. 3-2. Game 6 now. Kurt has to go and take the ball to be able to go and start Game 6. Second or third inning or so, the camera zooms in on his ankle. And what did he see there? Blood oozing out. What had happened? Kurt had actually had a devastating injury before that. He had ripped part of the tendon in his ankle. But he was so devoted to going out, persisting through this, that he said, "Doc, go and sew me up and get me out on the mound." And that was where the blood was coming into his sock, that the cameras were going and focusing. Think about that mindset. Think about that, and as an entrepreneur, do you think he might have what it takes to be an all-star entrepreneur? With that kind of driven mindset? Why? What characteristic would you point to?
Just determination to win, and nothing's going to get in his way.
Drive through a brick wall, nothing's going to stop me. So this is a bunch of the things that were going into his mindset. He ended up getting that reinforced by his success on the mound that day. Ended up being able to go far longer than anyone would have expected, and his team winning, and they go on to the World Series. So what do you think Kurt went and tried to do when he was retiring from baseball? Went and founded a company. So he went and founded a massive multiplayer online gaming company called 38 Studios, 38 after his uniform number. And he decided, I'm going to go and build this company. He was going and doing a bunch of things that we'll take a look at in a moment. This is just across the desk from him. This is Bill Thomas. This is one of the key right-hand men that he brought in to help him build it. Can you tell who the CEO is of this company? No, we can't really tell across here. We've got all sorts of ways. Would you expect the CEO to have his own office, maybe, within this company? A bunch of things that are going on here that we can go and see some glimpse of where these things are going next in terms of how we went and built it. This is one of the frameworks that we use when we're looking at founding teams. Call them the three R's. The relationships you tap, Kurt having gone and tapped friends to be able to go and bring them in. The roles and relationships, the way in which he went and built this team with Uncle Bill, Bill Thomas, on the across the desk that we saw from him there, and also the rewards. Let's go and take a look at a couple of the things that Kurt was making as decisions early on about how he's going to do the last two of them. So the roles and rewards, the roles and decision making, you already saw a little bit of across the table from someone that we can't even tell who is the CEO of this. When I went into that company, and I'm going to start to get to know them, they brought me in to go and help them work through some of their founding issues there. I met four senior executives, Kurt and three others, and I couldn't tell what the difference was in their jobs. I couldn't tell who was the CEO. I couldn't tell who was going to be the outside person, the inside person. Where do you think that, does that sound like a healthy way to go and build a team within a company? How should you be going and building that team? That what?
Fill your gap. You can't have two people in the same spot. It doesn't help.
Okay, so distinctiveness across the different people there. This is your lane that you're going to go and run in. This is your position that you're playing and other things like that. Okay, so it seemed to make all the most sense in the world to go and build it that way. Why didn't that happen for Kurt? Where was Kurt coming from when I burrowed into it? Everyone is a, so the shortstop is the same thing as a pitcher? Okay, but what part of the Red Sox was Kurt part of? Part of the starting rotation. Okay, so what does the starting rotation look like in terms of job definitions? What's the job description of the first starter, the ace?
I mean, pitchers are probably the toughest games when you get to the playoffs. He's probably the best pitcher. He's number one in the rotation.
Okay, so he's going first. Yeah. His job description is take the ball at the beginning of the game, throw it as hard and as well as you can for as long as you can, trying to keep your team in the game by giving up the fewest runs. What's the job description of the second starter? Same exact thing. Take the ball at the beginning of the game. Throw it as hard as you can for as well as you can for as long as possible to keep your team in the game, fewest runs. What's the job description of the third one? Exactly the same. Kurt had built the starting rotation of an executive team. Where was this coming from, his model? It's coming from what he had experienced for his entire life until then. 20 years worth of working in baseball had gone and shaped how he was going and building 38 studios. What did he go and do when it came to the rewards? Kurt wanted to go and bring in a brand new piece. A guy named Brett Close, who was going to be the been there, done that, experienced in the industry CEO, would finally give some definition to the team. And they ran aground on the negotiation over bringing him in. What had Brett said? Well, this looks like a great opportunity. I can see why you really do need me. You gave me my salary here on my offer. What is missing here? There's no equity stake. There's no amount of ownership that I'm going to get in this startup. What was Kurt's reaction to that? What did he point back to? What do you think he pointed back to in terms of to baseball and what?
No ownership.
No ownership. I didn't own anything of the Red Sox, even though I was the biggest star on it. What is the rule in baseball? Owners own, players play. Brett, owners own here, players play, you're a player, you don't own anything. That was where his mindset, his blueprint from baseball, he was going and applying, despite the fact that this is a very different context, despite the fact this is a key inflection point where he is going and changing from one industry to the other, and he is not realizing that there's a fundamental disconnect in terms of what his old blueprint was and what it applies to the new domain that he is going into. So this is an example of where within your blueprints, you're going to have some rude awakenings. If you don't go and think ahead to how is this context going to be different, go and breaking it down and being able to go and see where does this not apply, where do I have to go and adjust? It was only because other people were pushing back on Kurt that he was able to go and see where there's a disconnect to it. And we'll get into some of the implications for you when you're going into a next stage of life, when you're going into an inflection point where it is entirely possible that at least one element of your current blueprint is not going to apply. What are the ways that you can go and be able to make sure that you're not going to have a bunch of these rude awakenings that Kurt was going and facing? Okay, so let's go and take a look at one other thing. So this is an example where you have the unexpected that you're not going to be able to go and adjust to because some people haven't put it on your radar. There's also a lot of times, though, where we do have the expected, where we can tell that our blueprint doesn't apply and where we still have trouble going and adjusting to it. Is anyone familiar with the backwards bicycle? Has anyone seen that? It was a, what's backwards bicycle? Okay, terrific. So this is an engineer, as you were saying, Destin Sandler, who went and his pride and joy in life was, what was his major hobby? Bike riding. So this is what he went outside of work, what he went and prized the most. And then one day, a colleague of his gave him a bicycle that was different from other bicycles in just one way. As you were saying, when you go and turn the wheel left, when you go and turn your handlebars left, the wheel goes right, and vice versa. And so Destin said, okay, let me at it. I can see where my blueprint isn't going to apply. Let's go and see a little bit of the video where he's talking about some of the issues with that.
I learned how to ride a bike when I was really young. I had learned a life skill, and I was really proud of it. Everything changed, though, when my friend Barney called me 25 years later. Where I work, the welders are geniuses, and they like to play jokes on the engineers. He had a challenge for me. He had built a special bicycle, and he wanted me to try to ride it. He had only changed one thing. When you turn the handlebar to the left, the wheel goes to the right. When you turn it to the right, the wheel goes to the left. I thought this would be easy, so I hopped on the bike, ready to demonstrate how quickly I could conquer this.
And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Destin Sandler. First attempt riding the bicycle.
I couldn't do it. You can see that I'm laughing, but I'm actually really frustrated. Look, I know what you're probably thinking. Destin's probably just an uncoordinated engineer and can't do it. But that's not the case at all. The algorithm that's associated with riding a bike in your brain is just that complicated. I do not make definitive statements that often, but I'm telling you right now, you cannot ride this bicycle. You might think you can, but you can't. I know this because I'm often asked to speak at universities and conferences, and I take the bike with me. It's always the same. People think they're going to try some trick, or they're just going to power through it. It doesn't work. Your brain cannot handle this. For instance, this guy. I offered him $200 just to ride this bike 10 feet across the stage. Everybody thought he could do it. So here's what I did. It was a personal challenge. I stayed out here in this driveway, and I practiced about 5 minutes every day. My neighbors made fun of me. I had many wrecks, but after 8 months, this happened. One day, I couldn't ride the bike, and the next day, I could. It was like I could feel some kind of pathway in my brain that was now unlocked. It was really weird, though. It's like there's this trail in my brain, but if I wasn't paying close enough attention to it, my brain would easily lose that neural path and jump back onto the old road it was more familiar with. Any small distractions at all, like a cell phone ringing in my pocket, would instantly throw my brain back to the old control algorithm and I would wreck. But at least I could ride it. My son is the closest person to me genetically, and he's been riding a normal bike for 3 years. That's over half his life. I wanted to know how long it would take him to learn how to ride a backwards bike, so I told him if he learned how to ride a backwards bike, he could go with me to Australia and meet a real astronaut.
Are you going to give up?
No.
Go ahead. This is how it starts. Look at this. This is such a big deal. Get up. You got it. Did you see his brain get it? So he, in how many weeks have we been doing this? 2 weeks? In 2 weeks, he did something that took me 8 months to do, which demonstrates that a child has more neuroplasticity, am I even saying that right, than an adult.
Eh? What do we make of this? What do we think of this and where we started off? Does this give us any insights into why we had to go the long route instead of taking the fast route? Why would you have to go through 40 years worth in the Midbar rather than being able to go and fast forward to Eretz Yisrael? Okay, stuck in what mindset? What were the B'nai Yisrael stuck in? Okay, the slavery mindset. Could they have gone Kikarovu? Could they have gone and just fast forwarded straight from Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael? There was a lot more of the 8 months of what Destin was going through to be able to go and get himself out of that mindset. There was a lot more of what was going on in the Midbar. Moshe essentially bringing them along to be able to go and have them be thinking in a different way, getting rid of that mindset, that blueprint that had to go and adjust. So you've got the Abdus mindset, and then you've got the Cherus mindset. You've got the freedom, the country-building mindset, all sorts of ways in which, if they had fast-forwarded, they would have still been using the Avadim mindset when they got to Eretz Yisrael. And then it would have been a lot worse at being able to go and conquer the land, build the country, being able to do everything else that had to go into being able to go and do that in Eretz Yisrael. And so that's why, to me, the key, the simple shot on it, actually we get some insights from blueprints into why that actually was true, that they had to go and take the longer route because the other one was going to be a little bit too short. Are there any ways in which you can go and see ways in your lives that you've had to go and adjust your mindset, your blueprint, when you're in some kind of a new context? There are ways that you guys can relate? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have been through, you come from like Yeshiva in Israel, and you have like a very, maybe like looser, but also more tense like learning schedule, and then you kind of have to adjust that to like the basic.
Okay, interesting. So all of you just went through that blueprint adjustment that you were talking about, going from the yeshiva mindset into the dual curriculum mindset, the other things that you were going and pointing to. Could you have anticipated any of those changes ahead of time, proactively identified where there's going to be a disconnect and how I might be able to prepare for that?
You would have. Some of them are kind of like things you wouldn't think about.
Okay, so there's a mix of those two. So we started off with where you're blindsided by some of those disconnects, like what Kurt had. And then there's some of them that by going and putting a little bit of hishtadlus, a little bit of an investment into thinking proactively about where you're going to have a disconnect, being able to go and understand for maybe the people a couple of steps ahead of you who might be able to go and identify for you what were the biggest surprises that they had. Maybe you guys being able to go and mentor some of these students who are coming from Eretz Yisrael into here about what are some of the biggest things you guys had to adjust to, being able to go and do some of that favor of their blueprint adjustments that you go and facilitate. There's a great microcosm that you're highlighting of one of those inflection points in life. Did anyone go and have any kind of adjustment going from high school to yeshiva? Was that any kind of an adjustment? Okay, bunch of nodding heads here. You have from yeshiva into YU. Is anyone a senior here or heading out soon? Is there going to be any adjustment of going from the college blueprint into a work blueprint? You think there's going to be any of that? Okay, what do you think would be the biggest one? Let's go and work proactively on what might be the biggest adjustment that you have to make going to work now.
Dealing with secular colleagues.
Okay, so here the cloistered environment, you know, the cocoon that you're in here, and now having to grapple with a lot of the, I'm working as a frum yid in the secular world, and the adjustments you might have to be going and making there. It's actually one of the things we're working on right now within the Sims curriculum to be able to go and have you guys be prepared for a lot of the halachic issues, a lot of the shkafic issues in the workplace. And so that's what's going to be coming, Mirtz Hashem, in the fall to be able to go and do it. So there we might be able to go and help you make that adjustment. But otherwise, right now, what kind of ways you might be able to go and anticipate what some of them are. There's a series that's coming up of being able to go and help you understand workplace halacha here, being able to go and take some of those days and be able to make the most of them. And so some of the ways in which YU has a lot of these resources to help you with that, so that you're not going to, talking to a lot of the alumni who weren't able to go and benefit from these series that are here now and things like that, they had a very rude awakening. When they were finally now in that secular workplace, the professional world, and how they can go and meld that, not have to sacrifice things as the from a yid, how can you go and be establishing Koveya E-Team, having set times that you're going to be able to go and defend so you can go and do your learning? How can you go and make sure that you're going to have your work schedule be in sync with minion schedules and other things like that? And so that's some of the key things that you're going and highlighting as some of the other adjustments that are going to be coming up. But proactively working on that, practicing that here, being able to go and build those muscles is some of the key things to be able to go and not have the rude awakenings when the blueprints happen. Yeah, any other examples that you guys can come up with and when you're in a new situation and you have to go and adjust? Go ahead.
I moved here from Canada, so even coming to the States was a big adjustment.
Okay. What was the biggest one that you had to face?
People are very different.
Okay. Not as sweet as Canadians are?
Different. It's much busier here. It's much louder, it's much busier. So
uh-huh.
That's a big adjustment.
Interesting. How long did it take you to adjust to that?
Still
ongoing.
Yeah.
Check back in a decade.
Yeah, like that.
Okay, interesting. There's a Canadian founder that I work closely with, a guy who was the founder of something called Wiley Technology and now is the founder CEO of a public company. His name is Lou Cerny, Canadian. Very sweet guy. His Twitter handle is Sweet Lou. And that's a bit where I've gotten to see a little bit of that adjustment. In Silicon Valley, a Canadian having to go and make his way, the same kind of the blueprint adjustment that you're talking about having to go and make to here in New York. Any other ones come to mind? Go ahead.
Yeah, when I was 12, I moved to New Jersey from South Carolina. And probably the biggest adjustment was my first week in class. I got in trouble because I called my science teacher ma'am, which is a mandatory thing in South Carolina. It's a respect thing. You refer to your superiors as either ma'am or sir. And she thought that I was being chutzpahdik with her, and she kicked me right out of class.
Okay, that's great. So just a microcosm of a single word that is that adjustment that you're having to make across these different contexts and the values that people are going and putting on each of those words were radically opposite ones. This is covetic, and no, this is going and dissing that teacher as you're going into it. Great example in terms of that. Okay, so let me give you a couple of examples also. I don't know how many of you gone and experienced these, but when I used to go and teach a course in Scotland. I used to do this over the summer together. The head of entrepreneurship at MIT and I would go to Scotland together. I happen to love driving in other countries. Eretz Yisrael, I will go and rent a car just so I can have fun with the aggressiveness of the drivers there, being able to go and how can I show good midos despite some of the temptations that they have of what you're going to have to go and deal with of the other co-drivers that they're on the road. And so I love driving in foreign countries. Scotland, for that program, one of my conditions for it was you have to have someone drive me around. Why do you think that is?
Other side of the car.
Other side of the road. What is going to go and happen? One wrong turn, and that's the end of it. But wait, this is an explicit thing. You'd know that they're driving on another side of the road. Why can't you go and adjust to it? It's just like riding the bike, just like the backwards bicycle. It's explicit. He can see that when you turn the handlebars this way, the other, but yet we have to go and work on ourselves to go and adjust to it. I was scared that I was going to be this guy right in the middle, driving up the wrong side of the road with everyone else going in the opposite as me. The old line about a guy who calls up his wife and says, everyone here is nuts when they're driving. They're all going the wrong direction. Well, honey, actually, you're the one who's on the wrong side of the road. That would be me making the one wrong turn. And just trying to go and see in Australia, they go and explicitly try to help you correct to that. No, we drive on the other side of the road here. One too many Americans who got wiped out by an Australian driver that they go and try to give these explicit ones. But there's all sorts of ways also when I was going and taking a look into it. There's on Fodor, they have a discussion among people who drive on the wrong side of the road or people who are going to a country that drives on the other side. And there are all sorts of horror stories about things they tried to go and do to remind themselves, put some kind of a siman, some kind of a signal to go and remind yourself that every time you're turning the wheel, you should do it the other way. And yet they still had to go and have all sorts of ways that there were very close calls that they had to go and deal with. So this is where we have to go and retrain ourselves and delve into some of those mindsets in terms of even when you're going as a pedestrian. Do you have to go and adjust when you're in a new country?
Right in London, they have, on the crosswalks downtown, they have a sign, look, and they point the arrow in the right direction. Because there's so many positive tourists looking the wrong direction, crossing the street, right into traffic.
Okay, exactly. That one too many of those Americans got blindsided by looking this way, and actually the car was coming the other direction. So this is something I actually saw in one of our airports. This is in Salt Lake City. We don't even have to go as far as England to be able to go and see that. They have the same thing there. Right there before you're about to step into a crosswalk, they're going and making sure that you understand that you've got to look in both directions. Your natural inclination, that blueprint that you have of where cars are going to be coming from, that you have to go and reset that. And so those are some of the things that we can go and see in these walks of life. Let's just go and see in terms of some other reflections that you have. In Yiddishkeit, do we see any ways in which we have blueprints enter into some of the things that we have? Chazal teach us about these things or halachic reasons that we can go and see where blueprints go and change some of the ways in which we go and look at things? Any examples that come to mind? The Gemara or from halacha, any other sayings that we have of things that came down from Chazal? Go ahead.
A lot of them have been talking about how to wrap tefillin, and that like it's also like a muscle memory thing that either like you wrap in or wrap out, and that like if you're using someone else's tefillin and they do it the other way, then it's a whole ball of gum to try and figure out how to wrap tefillin.
Okay, so acknowledging that you're going to lapse into your blueprint even when it's a different setup of the tefillin,
yeah.
And being able to go and check that. Yep.
And then we have to make a bracha on good things and as well as bad things or bad things that seemingly are bad to us.
Okay, so that natural inclination that we have of this is something bad, we have to go and get ourselves into the blueprint of it's a Gamzul HaTova or there's some other way that we have to have bitachon about these kinds of things, so being able to go and correct against that. Hey, any other ones that we'd go and point to? From any of the things that we can go and see, Torah, Chazal, Gemara, or anything like that? Any other ones that come to mind?
Yeah, you saw the Mishnah and Avos about the bottle. Don't assume that the contents match the bottle.
Okay, interesting. There's another one in Avos that is going and talking about the paper that we're writing on. Is that an echo of what you're talking about there? Or the? Okay, so this is Avos Dalet Chaf talking about it. Ironically, this is the most ironic source of a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Who is that one citing? Elisha ben Avuya. So one time we go and have explicitly that we're talking about Acher and we're learning something from him, and it's right up the alley of what you're talking about. The difference between writing on a piece of paper when it is blank, when you don't have any blueprint yet, how that is a lot easier than writing on an ER that has been erased, and how much harder it is to be able to go and write well on that. Think about undoing blueprints. It's right up the alley of that. Being able to go and see how, go and develop your blueprint. There was a shiur that was given by Rabbi Turetsky that I listened to. I was actually going to Shalavim when I was in Israel a couple of weeks ago. On the way to it, I fortunately listened to his shiur because in the base mentor, he came up and introduced himself to me. And so I was able to go and thank him for going and teaching me on the way to it. He was talking about how can you go and retain your learning the best? What is the number one rule that he had within there, the first one that he had? Learn it right to begin with. Don't go and be the piece of paper that's going to have to be erased. Go and have it be a blank piece of paper. Have it be done right to begin with. And so those are some of the other ways that we can go and see some echoes of that. Another one?
Rava hears a shot and he doesn't accept it, and then a bunch of years later hears the Chacham give the same shot and he accepts it, and he's upset that he didn't accept it when he was younger because he would have been able to retain it better.
Okay, interesting. So that's in terms of remembering it, and also where in some ways the resistance, even when we are a blank piece of paper, of our resistance to being able to see how it fits into our blueprint might get in the way of our being able to go and do that. Okay, so one of them we have the Mishnah of Pirkei Avos about the erasing of the piece of paper. Are there any implications for you? This goes back to one of the things that we didn't really talk about in the backwards bicycle, about stage of life where it makes sense for you to go and learn new things. Gets a little bit into the Rava piece and things like that. What are some of the ways that this has implications for when you should go and try to do something new in life? Should you go and wait, or should you do it earlier? So what would it be?
The
earlier the better, because
clearly it's easier to pick up the skills.
Okay, you'll pick up the new skills because you're not having to undo learning. You're not having to go and reset the clock, go and battle your blueprint that's existing. And so this has some implications for you of how you go and dive into new realms of knowledge, how you go and experience new things and the time of life to be able to go and do that also. Coming up, a couple of parshas from now, where do we have a difference between something that's done something couple of times versus done it more than that? An animal. Shor Tam and Shor Muad. That's where we can go and see that we're establishing this blueprint and whether it is that it's shifted into a new domain, that we're going to be able to go and see how it's going to be different at that point or not, that it takes a little bit to go and adjust on the way to it. Okay, in terms of another one, in terms of that, okay, should this is actually from recently in the DAF, where it had echoes of it. This is bringing it more from elsewhere in Shas, is from Sota, when we're going and taking a look, Chav Beis, where it revisits Shalol Lishma, Bal Lishma, that when you go and do something that's not Lishma, that it's not for its own sake, and then over time you go and do it, is that something you can just cut to immediately? Of going from doing something Shalol Lishma and go right into doing Lishma? That is something where you have to go and adjust over time, be able to recreate your blueprint. On this, the Eitz Yosef goes and says that it actually takes more than one time doing something Lishma for you to establish that you've gone and made that transition. So that blueprint that you had of doing it Shalol Lishma, you can't go all of a sudden, go and do the Kikarovhu, that go and take the shortcut to being able to go and do Lishma. You have to over time be able to go and show that this is a different mode that you're in. You're going to have a very different blueprint that you're going and doing it. Let me give you one last one in terms of a personal story. Okay, this is going back a year and a half ago. But my son, younger son, was being bar mitzvah, Parshas Korach. Happened to be, when we looked at the calendar, that afternoon at Shabbos Mincha, that was going to be the 36th anniversary, the double chai anniversary, of my own bar mitzvah. I had done both Chukas and Balak. I was sentenced to do a double parsha. Okay, but I wanted to go in lane just to go and mark that. Let me go and do the first aliyah of Chukas. I'm going to lane at Shabbos Mincha. The rabbi in the shul that I go and daven in on Shabbos Mincha said no. He refused for me to go and do that. Why do you think that is? Well, first off, what do you see in terms of this word? What does that say? Chukas. Does anyone read it differently? How would a Sephardi go and say it? Chukat. For some reason, my blueprint around how I pronounce things had been set back in first or second grade by, I assume, a Sephardi teacher. I pronounce it chukat. I have a Sephardi havara when I am going and pronouncing things. The Rav of that shul said, you can't do a Sephardi havara when you are going and laning for us here. It has to be Ashkenazis. And so that's why he was going and refusing to let me go and do it. So I told him, I will go and work on undoing the 36 years worth of damage to be able to go and do it the way you want. And it was the most difficult thing that I've ever gone and had to do when it comes to laning. There's laning a brand new Parsha. There's being able to go and write a new Parsha on the piece of paper that hasn't been erased yet. That's a fresh piece of paper. This was having to go and erase all of the suffs that I had gone and ignored and said were toughs, and to go and undo that. And when I was going and laning, I couldn't be on autopilot. It goes back to when Destin was talking about when his phone goes off in the middle of his ride and he's thrown off the bike. I had to be paying attention to every single letter along the way. I messed up one of them and had to go and back up. And this is where we're going and seeing just a little microcosm of what Rav Teresky was going and saying. Learn it right to begin with so that you don't have to go and hit the undo key on your blueprint. And so just one little one-letter microcosm of it when it came to that. Final one in terms of some of the examples we'll take a look at. Azir Kenegdo. This is going and revisiting what we saw in terms of Rav Elazar ben Pedas and going and adjusting to what Rav Yochanan needed in terms of a Chavrusa. What does Rashi tell us about Azir Kenegdo? What is his shot on it? Go ahead.
Rashi, but this past week in Parshas in Parshas Beyer, when it talks about Barad, Rashi talks about the fire and the water, and they made Shalom for a higher purpose.
Okay. So as we're coming together to be able to go and do that, Rashi on Azir Kenegdo says,
Zacha, she'll help him. Zacha, she'll be against him.
Okay, so if you are worthy, she will help you. She will be the buttressing for you, the support. But if you get the pushback, what does that say? That you were not meriting. That you were, there was something deficient in you. When we go and take a look at, this is where we can go and see, that's Rashi's perspective on it. We have a very different perspective that the Netziv brings to it. The Netziv says, instead, that the kenegdo, the pushback, is actually the helping. The kenegdo is the ezer. What were we going and seeing when we take a look at this that we took a look at before with Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish? Well, when he was going and be Messiah, he was going and providing a support for everything Rav Yochanan said. Who was he doing? Was he going and doing Rashi? Or was he going and doing the Netziv? He was going and doing Rashi. We have to go, and the main thing that we have to do is support each other. And instead, how is Rabbi Yochanan coming at it with it? Who is Rabbi Yochanan being? Rabbi Rashi or the Netziv? He was being the Netziv. He was saying, by going and pushing back on me, by being the Kenegdo, that is how you're going to help me rise to the heights that I had before. We have the two competing blueprints that they were going with. If we look at Rashi, and we go and look back at where that saying came from, what was the origin of, if you're not Zoche, then you have the Kenegdo? Who do you think said that in the Gemara? Where was Rashi drawing on it from? Rav Elazar ben Pedas. It was an ingrained blueprint that he had that said that this is how you go and act when it is that you're doing the Ben Adam HaVera, when you're interacting with other people here, that you go and support them. Why couldn't he go and adjust? It was so ingrained in him. He was the proponent of it, of that you don't go and push back, you go and support each other. And that's where we had the competing blueprints between the two of them and Rav Elazar ben Pedas' inability to go and adjust to that blueprint. And so it's some of the things we have to go and tune into in terms of that. One interesting other thing that came up when I was at my brother's house in Eretz Yisrael, he pointed out to me in terms of blueprints that Chazal say, why was Moshe Rabbeinu one of the reasons that he was picked to go and lead B'nai Yisrael into the Midbar? What was Moshe Rabbeinu's blueprint? Was it the Abdus blueprint? No, Moshe Rabbeinu did not go and have that same suffering as an Eved, that same kind of slave mentality that we said we had to go and break out by going the 40 years in the desert. Moshe Rabbeinu, because of the early days with Basporo and the other things like that, he did not have to go and break out of that blueprint the same way that B'nai Israel needed 40 years to go and do it. And so that's where we have a bunch of these things all coming together in terms of seeing where there's lots of echoes of, can you identify the disconnects? Can you go and be able to tell how you're approaching things? And in this new situation, are you going to be able to adjust to it or not? And how you might be able to proactively do that? And so some of the things that we went and took a look at in terms of the ways in which you can do it, take a look across your blueprint as you went and highlighted about coming from yeshiva to YU. Find what is the biggest way in which I'm going to have a rude awakening? What is the biggest way in which I'm going to have to go and adjust in this new context or heading out to the working world? Go and identify that ahead of time and see how you might be able to work on it. Go and learn maybe from some other people about the way in which you're going to be able to go and learn from their experiences. Maybe set up some reminders for yourself, checkpoints that go and have the same kind of thing that people were putting on their steering wheel when they were going and driving on the other side of the road. Other reminders for yourself, maybe putting in on your calendar at work all the minion times. You're not going and scheduling anything that are going to conflict with it. Or the same kind of thing in terms of your chavrusas and koveya itim. Other ways that you have that reminder about those priorities. As you talked about, also go and find other people who can throw darts at you, who can be the Reish Lakishes, to go and be able to push back against where you are not fitting the situation that you're in. They can go and identify for you where you are going to have a rude awakening, and by proactively identifying it, you can go and work on it ahead of time. Or, as we talked about before, this is Brett Close. This is a person who's pushing back. Kurt, you're going to have to adjust when it comes to owner's own, player's play. Find those people in life who can go and play that kind of a role of being your kenegdo, being able to go and be the azer, the helping of you, by going and pushing back on it. Some of the other things to be going and keeping in mind in terms of the blueprints also. You, a lot of times, are going to be working with other people who are going to have very different blueprints than you do. You're off in the working world, and you have people, maybe also other from people, who have other ways in which they're going to go and explain why they have to leave early for Shabbos. Or other ways that they're going to explain why it's actually okay for them to be at that orientation lunch that's at a treif restaurant, and they are going to do something different than you. Go and identify where your blueprint might be different from theirs, and go and see if you can go and resolve that where you have multiple competing blueprints. Another one that came up before when we were talking about it, go and yourself try to go and develop multiple blueprints. Go and get a rich set of experiences. Go and be able to understand different ways that you can go and approach things. This is also where we're going and melding the blueprints of the morning program and the afternoon program. be able to go and see the different ways in which each of them can go and help each other, and be able to go and craft that, so that when you are going and morphing from one stage of life into a new situation, that you'll be able to be a lot more armed than Kurt Schilling was, than those people on the road were in Scotland, and all the other ways in which we see some of those. And in particular, as we already talked a little bit about, as you're heading to the next stage of life, leaving YU and heading off into the real world, the other kind of real world, that you're going and being able to be prepared as possible. And so think about each of those at each of these inflection points of life. Step back, pull back on the reins, and think through what you can proactively identify and be able to go and find the people who can go and help you through that stage. So thank you guys for coming. Slacha rabba with the rest of the month.